Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Nutrition Network. And today we're really lucky to have an old friend. I say an old friend because actually we're quite recent friends, really. But Amit Oberoi, who has kept, among lots of people, but has kept me going for the last 2 years with gossip. And we've had, you know, it's been fun, hasn't it, Amit? You know, sort of like us chatting away for the last couple of years. So how are you today?
I'm well, thanks, Kate. Yeah, definitely. I suppose we met back in 2018. So it's going back a few years. 2018.
Yeah, so it's going back away. Yeah. And we sort of, we'll sort of say why we met in a minute, maybe. But first of all, Amit, just tell us, you know, you describe yourself as a neurotherapist and you're from TRF, which you founded. So what is that? What does it do?
Yeah, look, I sort of started out of the neuroscience sort of in the late 90s when it wasn't that fashionable. It was very clinical, working in hospitals, dealing with people that really were on the spectrum of sort of dementia, brain sort of injuries. And, you know, for myself, I wanted to be more in the proactive. So I went into psychology and then moved into sort of the corporate market to look at how can you do preventative work, and then sort of made my way through risk management. It was probably back in 2014, 2015, where I thought, look, neurotherapy has really advanced and it's portable, it's small. You can actually take that into someone's home or you can have a clinic where it's not so invasive. And it's really about rewiring the brain using EEG technology.
So what is EEG? I mean, that's sort of like, it must be electromagnetic, something.
No, electroencephalograph.
Right.
So it's, you know, obviously putting the wires onto the brain. And then looking at brain functionality. And so,
wow. So,
you know, anyone can come to you from the perspective of being, hey, I've got a bit of brain fog. You know, I've been talking to a nutritionist. They're giving me things to help with my gut biome. I've got that under control, but I'm still feeling sluggish. I've got levels of anxiety. You know, I've got the nutrition sorted. That's sort of working well for me. That's giving me, putting me into a really solid state. But now, cognitively speaking, how can I enhance that? And what I've been doing, Kate, is that a lot of people are coming and seeing me in concert with the nutritionist or in concert with other allied health practitioners. And then this is like the finishing piece. So what we say is get all of the base set, you're building a home, get the foundations right. And then with what we offer, that then helps the cognitive ability. So we are finding people, you know, at the moment, obviously, even prior to COVID, but emotional, you know, high emotions, overthinking, highly anxious due to chronic stress, and they can't relieve that. You know, it's like, hey, go and do meditation, but that doesn't work for everyone and that can take years. So what we can do with it's all FDA approved in the States. We sit people down, it's a coaching session, but they will then rewire the brain either watching a video or playing a video game with their mind. And so they have to then produce the brain waves that we set. So for example, if you've got very, very high beta, we would like to reduce the high beta. You know, if you've got this like other waves coming in that we don't need, like a high theta or something like that, we can work on how you adjust and get focused. And it's all about taking your attention from point A to point B to do a task. And that's how it trains the brain, operant conditioning. So
can you kind of, is it sort of diagnostic as well, which is you can sort of tell where it's going wrong and presumably not really why, but you can see it's like, I don't know. You can see where the problem lies in effect.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, look, there you spend time addressing the diagnostic ability up front to get a baseline. It's all about that baseline through some techniques that we have. And then the gameplay comes into it. So it's gamified training, but the diagnostics up front. So we like to get a baseline. So what we say is that everyone can have impairments through trauma. It could be all different things in your life. You're still here, you're still surviving, you're still cognitively functioning. But if you want an enhancement, you need to understand, go back. And, you know, we've got a couple of clients that, you know, forgot they had falls when they were young children. So they had a traumatic brain injury, but it wasn't that traumatic. So their parents didn't think anything of it. Now that they're in their late 40s, coming to sort of their, into their early 50s, they're saying, hang on a minute, I'm forgetting things and what's happened. So they went and did a functional MRI and they said, actually, you've sustained a brain injury. And they're asking their parents, you know, going back and look, Oh, that's right. Yeah, I fell off a slide. So these things can manifest as you get older. And what we're saying, so what we can do with that is help repair those areas. And it takes time, but you can help repair those areas.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, things like my husband has played a lot of rugby. I mean, he was out like a light every single match on those game, you know, rugby injuries. So, you know, even going back that far, but I mean, can you detect the injury in the brain? Or so is it sort of like, that's definitely an injury. And this is definitely something else like a chemical damage or some other type of damage, or is it not that?
Yeah.
Sensitive?
Yeah, you can. Look, the brain rewires itself. So a couple of the guys that are like great mentors to myself, they are specializing in NFL football players. And we know a lot about the NFL. Obviously, there was a movie that was made many years ago about these concussion syndromes. They are present, and the brain is a fantastic machine, although it being very simplistic in its design, where it's a pattern recognizing machine, it does rewire, has the ability. However, there is, for every gain, there is a loss. And so, you know, certain brain functions need to be there to optimally function, and they can rewire and go into other places, but your brain still will not be overall harmonized. So what we look for is we can see if the brain's not functioning at that specific point, say it's prefrontal cortex, which is the radar of your brain, brings in all the sensory information. If that's not firing right, you can see why. There can be behaviors that are at-risk behaviors. You know, there can be a whole heap of things that are manifesting in your day-to-day life that you think, hang on a minute, why is that happening? There's got to be an answer for it. And people say, oh, that's just Kate, or that's just Amit. That's just the way they've always behaved. But that can be due to some sustained incident or injury at some point in your life as well. So we can work that out, look at that, and then just start training it. It's like going to the gym. You want bigger biceps, we work on the biceps. If you want a stronger prefrontal cortex, we can work on that area. If you want, you know, better control of your emotions, we go to the temporal and so forth, because there's 20 points on the scalp we can train. So it's very fascinating science.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I read a book ages ago, which is called Dr. Amen. Dr. Amen, you know, typical American. And he does SPECT scanning, which is looking at blood flow. It's sort of like there's quite a lot of controversy around what he does, because they sort of, you know, of course, people with different vested interests say, oh, it's all a load of rubbish. To be honest, I'm not a judge of whether it is or not. But what was interesting from that is, of course, he offers the kind of problem, which is like, you've got a problem, because he can see it in the scan. But obviously has a big foundation of nutrition to set it right. But I don't know that he does any of this kind of work, which is really interesting about the retraining, because I think obviously it's about identifying the problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
Then it's about knowing how, you know, how to solve the problem. And of course, a big part of that, you would say, is the nutrition part, lifestyle part, and all of those things. But the final, you know, I think it is absolutely an analogy to your point, isn't it? Which is like, you know, you can eat a healthy diet. You can't, you know, you can't run your, for weight loss, for example, you can't run your way to weight loss through just running and exercise. It's obviously a nutrition thing, but obviously the exercise bit really does help. So in this analogy, it's like, yeah, you can do the lifestyle stuff. You can do all of this stuff. You can do the scanning, identify the problem, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, you need to do the heavy lifting, as you said, and the training to really make chase the needle to make a difference.
100%. And, you know, like I say, if you've got the foundations right through diet, lifestyle, and then you're doing this as well, what happens is after X amount of training sessions for the person, it might be 10 for some people, it might be 20, it might be 30, then you only need to tune up every once in a while, because you've got control over that part of the master computer. The control system is your brain. Once you've got control over that adequately, then you've already got the building blocks. So you're on a path to being healthy and successful and, you know, whatever you need to be. I think a lot of people get that mismatch. They're sort of dabbling a little bit of this, a little bit of that, not really setting a proper program for themselves. So it's like, hey.
Yeah, that's so typical of exercise as well, isn't it? You know, it's that sort of like expecting miracles, doing it for a bit and then just dropping it. So for you and your clients, obviously, how long is a piece of string? I would imagine, because it depends on the nature of the problem. But sort of typically, how many sessions do they come to it? And what does a session kind of look like?
Yeah, look, we generally do 10 sessions to start with. So within 10 sessions, you start to feel a dramatic change. Like people say, I feel more in control. We're hearing the word resilient. I feel more resilient, which is great because that brings me on to the other part of this. So we start off with 10. After we've done the primary diagnosis in the first session, then we do about 20 minutes of gameplay. And what we say to people is, look, we will try to determine how we can help you. And then we go into the 10 sort of session type framework. Otherwise, we'll say to people, look, I think you need to go and seek more assistance through a nutritionist or other people if they're not doing that, because it doesn't sort of work that well if they haven't got the basis right as well. So we like to work with other health practitioners because we don't want to say to someone, look, just keep coming and doing this when we know that they've, you know, they don't have the right amino acid, you know, formulations already, because we know that the gut produces all the neurotransmitters and we need the healthy gut in order to maximize what we're training. So if they've done all that right, within 10 sessions, we see dramatic changes. And I've got a couple of clients now that, you know, are saying to me, they don't feel as stressed anymore. They feel more calm. One's a CEO and he just said, look, I was really struggling. I thought I couldn't cope anymore, but it's actually the fact that now I've got more bandwidth. So that makes us feel very happy with what we're doing.
And do clients have to come to you physically?
We have to do that physically. So we have to actually sit them in a chair in a relaxed environment. They get to.
Oh, because you've got to put the electrodes. Yeah, got it. So it's not something they can do. But you are based in London. So a lot of our practitioners are based in London.
I'm going up to Manchester to see a sports physician. So we work with all different people. We've worked with sporting teams as well, all different people in different functions.
I mean, you were talking a little bit there about sort of case history, but can you sort of out of your head pick somebody who sort of springs to mind of and how the journey might go for them?
Yeah, sure. Look, essentially, you may feel that you're not in control of something, or you've got brain fog, or you're feeling that, you know, like something isn't right, and you may have tried things. Basically, it's to come in, talk about those how you're feeling and the behaviors you're exhibiting, or if someone else is exhibiting those behaviors. Sometimes it's parents that bring their children in because they've tried everything and they don't know what's happening. And then it's for us then to sit down and have the discussion and then do the diagnosis. So we pick with eyes open functioning, eyes closed functioning in three locations, being in the frontal, medial, and posterior of the brain. And then we'll get them to do the attention and focus game, get them attention and focus, and then we can see how the brain's functioning in real life. And then we can say, well, I think this is what's happening. Let us review this. And then by them actually addressing what's going on in their life with what we can see live with the brain functioning, we can pretty much understand what's going on. Is it, you know, highly functioning anxiety? Is it ADHD? We're finding a lot of people now having this adult ADHD. It was just undiagnosed of, you know.
What does that look like, somebody with that?
It's really interesting because with people, it's quite the high achievers, which, you know, people with ADHD have got a lot of energy. So high energy, high functioning, and you're one of them, Kate Baldwin.
I was just wondering. I was like, oh, I've got a lot of energy.
It's a good thing. I think it's a great thing. These are just labels, right? But if you can control it, it's a great thing to have in your arsenal because it's high energy, high functioning. However, you're more susceptible to burnout. You get irritable very easily. You tend to have some highs and lows at points. And we're seeing a lot of that because once your energy diminishes during the day, if you're not topping that up, we find a lot of people, you know, as I was drinking, I was having coffee, you know, constantly living off coffee is another telltale sign. So we're seeing a lot of that happening. And I guess those sort of people, if they're working in a team environment, are the ones holding the team together. They're driving the agenda. So post-COVID now, a lot of people are coming in to say, hey, I'm feeling really burnt out. It's a word they're using a lot. I'm feeling burnt out. I'm feeling exhausted. I don't know my purpose. And I'm like, hey, hang on, hold back. What were the things you were doing successfully and why? Work through that. And then as we see the brain functioning, we're seeing really, really high levels of high levels of this anxiety that's present.
Yeah, I think that's so true. I mean, You know, it's interesting, the anxiety thing, isn't it? Because obviously it could be really physiological. I mean, i.e., as you so rightly point out, gut health and sort of chemical load generally, you know, I don't know. People may have had bad lifestyles in the past and all of this thing kind of coming up to catch them, smack them in the back of the head, so to speak, with all of it catching up. But I think in modern life, there's no real relief, is there, from the anxious state, you know, which is quite interesting. It's a sort of free-floating anxiety. You know, there's nothing, and to your point as well, I think go nicely with that purpose-driven agenda as well, because there's one, sorry, I'm going all over the place here, but the first is really a point that there is a lot of this anxiety around, probably through lots of different mechanisms, and also through the fact that, you know, our culture is not purpose driven. I mean, there's really, we don't make things, we just move things around from sort of one column of numbers to another column of numbers. And it's pretty much, you know, I can't remember, I must read this book. It's called Bullshit Jobs. I'd love to read this book. But basically, a lot of people are in these bullshit jobs, you know, and actually there's no purpose to it. So of course they feel anxious from that point of view. That's really interesting. But I was going to say, what was I going to say about that? Yes, I can't remember, about purpose, I think. So that's just presumably in your coaching, do you look at that side of that purpose side, or is that sort of your coaching side is more lifestyles driven?
Well, look, I like to get a holistic view of the person. And I guess because that leads to different discussions. Sometimes that can be the fact that, hey, I hate my job, I've got no time for other things, but my job's paying for my lifestyle. And so what we like to do is find out everything that's happening in someone's life to get a full understanding. So that's the personability part of it. And then obviously you've got your tools and you've got your other techniques and things you use, but it's about building that personable approach, understanding what's going on in your life, because sometimes it might not be any of these other issues. It could be the fact that you're not eating well, you're not sleeping well, you're a high-functioning person that's a lack of confidence. Something's happened, which sounds very basic, but that can send you on a whole whirlwind of other issues, you know, that can erode things. And I guess that leads us to the resilience factor, that it's holistic. It's about measuring the person.
Yes, which is interesting, because I think this is really how we met through the resilience factor, which is, for people listening, it's a tool, a questionnaire based tool, which is backed up by neuroscience as well, that determines where people, in effect, where they've got a hole in their resilience bucket. Would you say that's a fair description?
I think that's a great description, Kate. I
was resilience bucket. You like that? Resilience
bucket, a hole in your bucket.
So, you know, and I think this is where, you know, we like to, you know, we thought that the practitioners might be interested. First of all, you know, obviously with your work with the as a neurotherapist. So if clients are struggling, you know, you've done everything you can in the nutrition world, you know, actually just might be worth considering, you know, sending these people to Amit or having a chat with Amit. We'll go through your details at the end. But also, you know, actually the resilience factor is this questionnaire based tool is a very easy, quick 10 minute. It's not a clinical analysis, obviously, but it might be a very good sort of so-called marketing tool to get people in your funnel. So clients in your funnel, to get them just interested to do quite a reasonably priced assessment that then they can do four times a year. And it just gets them thinking more broadly about their health and obviously their nutrition. But it's like almost like you could use it as a checkup, couldn't you? To say, right, hi, you know, it's time for your resilience factor checkup. So do you want to, sorry, I'm stolen your thunder a little bit there, Amit. But do you want to just talk through how that might help?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So basically, I think some of the times we've all got our different tools and techniques, but in order to understand the population you're dealing with, your clients doing this, that takes 10 minutes, can identify what are the seven key areas of their life that they're having some concern or challenges with. And then that can help you get a better understanding. So when we were devising this, you know, we were sitting around and thinking, we're working with other peers in the industry, was like, resilience is a thing. We know what it is. We know that we're covering four dynamics of health, being mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual, being your sense of purpose. But how do you measure that? What does that actually mean to people? And so we identify very quickly the seven key drivers in your life, being how you manage your thoughts, your emotions, manifestation of stress, relationships, self-development, and previous adversity slash trauma. We're able to very quickly identify the people coming into seeing us as practitioners and coaches. So then we're able to say, hey, these are the areas in your life that are causing you a lot of grief.
Yes.
We now set you on a path to help you with that. And that helped us a lot, because what we were finding is it can become a scattergun approach. They come in with multiple of symptoms, multiple pathologies. They've done so many different things. These are people you want to help because, you know, you're in the caring profession, but you couldn't really help them adequately because there was no measure. And
That is so true. And also, as I say, it's identifying, you know, because we are the type of nutritionists, the nutritional therapists that do clinical work. So it's kind of like, obviously, somebody comes in with a lot, sometimes with quite complicated, complex kind of symptoms. And the thing is, you know, okay, you can address the actual symptoms, but, you know, we sometimes, if people are trying to be rude about nutritional therapists, they call us lifestyle nutritionists, which I think is, I'm going to take that, because, you know, so much of it is to do with that hole in the bucket, you know. And if you can identify the hole in the bucket where the sort of resilience is dribbling away, but you have your clinical assessment, obviously, as well, you're so much more likely to be able to sort of stem the hole, if you'll go on with that analogy. So it is about identifying those lifestyle places, and to see over time if, you know, we were saying, well, you know, sometimes it's not a measure of, hang on, you were at 4 and now you're at 10. Obviously, these different segments of their life can change and fluctuate over time. So it's just sometimes it's just about change rather than it being good or bad. Is
correct.
That fair?
Yeah, there's no good or bad. I mean, the what people are starting to realize is you can't change your life in a dramatic level year to year. You have to make incremental change for it to be consistent and sustained. So what we say to people is, if you can focus on the thing that's causing you the most angst, and sometimes it's very confrontational for the person because it's difficult, right? But if you can work on, say it's relationships and you're having a hard time with relationships, if you can actually address the issue that it is relationships and work on that driver in your life, and you get a 5% increase, you have less anxiety overall because you've dealt with something, and you get more confidence. And this confidence thing is really underrated, but when you become more confident with the skill, and you look at children, you know, they're the perfect example. When they become more confident in something, they'll tell everyone about it, and they're like, oh, look at me, I can do this now, I can read. It's no different to us as adults. We sort of diminish that. We lose our confidence very quickly. And then what do? We shy away from the thing that's causing us the pain, and it sets us on this whole spiral. Then our health gets diminished, our well-being goes down, our quality of life ultimately is suffering. So what we say is, what is the thing that is the most greatest challenge? Now, it might be several areas of your life, but start with one, look at that for 3 months, and you'll see, once you start to develop your greater resilience to that, your life will change, and people start saying, wow. And it sounds very simple. It is a bit more difficult, but it is that easy as saying, right, I've now done the index. I've identified that it's relationships. I'm going to do something every day to improve that relationship.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is a really important part of what we do as actually nutritional therapists, is that, and actually my clinic is called the Nutrition Coach for that reason, which is, and I started off actually as a coach, and it's a horrible title, isn't it? Because it's very American. It's that sort of, what is it, a life coach? It's like, oh, that's such a horrible title. But I actually am a qualified life coach. But because I saw that actually the lifestyle factors was almost kind of more important than the nutritional factors in a one way, because you can ask people to change their diet, you can ask them to take supplements, you can ask them to do all this stuff. If their life is one big fat mess, then they just don't stick to things, you know. And it's about knowing what incremental changes you're asking them to do, as opposed to just maybe focusing on totally the wrong area.
Yeah, exactly. And And that's why we wanted to develop a metric, because they're answering the questions themselves. So, you know, you do get pushback from clients, customers, and people that you're working with, but you say, that's how you answered that question. So it's something subconsciously that you want to bring up that might be confrontational. That's fine. But you've answered the question in that way because that's what you need area of focus. But that's fine. And then you just step them through a process. And these are all just tools to help with any coach to become, you know, sort of fast tracked. It's a quicker way to getting that data, because, you know, data is everything in this industry, and you're only as good as what your information you're receiving. So we like to get that information. And then as me as a neurotherapist, I use that then to say, well, okay, now I know that it's a relationship going on here. So it could be a divorce. It could be fighting with family. It could be work-related issues. So that will also help me identify where I need to focus, you know, in my practice.
Your attention. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I think the lifestyle issues are really important, because I think stress has got to be at the bottom of nearly all, you know, issues, I guess. I'm just trying to think. I mean, obviously, stress in terms of chemical stress, so being exposed to toxins, stress, that kind of stress. But I mean, I think emotional stress obviously has got to be up there as the major driver for ill health.
We're seeing emotional regulation or dysregulation and overthinking absolutely massive since COVID. Before, you would see that in really high functioning people that were very hard on themselves, but now we're finding it's across the board where people are, you know, doomsday prepping to a degree, thinking what's next. And then, you know, you wake up in early March, and then there's an invasion in Ukraine, and people, and what I'm saying to people, there's a lot of distractions in life popping up. You've got to sort of unhinge those distractions, which is hard for some people, but that's the overthinking part. And there's the coming to it as well.
Well, it's completely understandable, the old doomsday prepping. In fact, you know, no, I'm not joking. I'm not making light of it. I was doing that a year ago. I was like, got my tins in. I think I peaked too early. You know, I've now gone through all my tins. And now everybody's saying it's now. I'm like, oh, no, I'm always ahead of the curve. Ugh. And anyway,
there's no harm in having that. But when it's creating so much angst in your life where you're becoming frozen, you're forgetful, you're doubting yourself, you don't want to leave the house, then you're losing your quality of life. And I guess everything we do is it's about enhancing quality of life and measuring that. And I think we've forgotten that. It's like we're here to have a quality of life. We're social animals. We want to be out. When that gets hampered, whether it be, you know, a nutritional issue or whether it be a cognitive issue or whatever it is in your life, that you want relief. You just want to get that relief so you can go back out in the population and have fun and enjoy your life. And I guess that's what's been forgotten about a bit over the last couple of years. It's like,
yeah, absolutely. You know, it's what, you know, it's absolutely one thing to just get the money in and feed yourself and just those basics. But of course, I think it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs or whatever it is, you know, it's about that self-actualization. You know, once your shelter and all the food is basic needs are taken care of, then you do need to search for some higher purpose, which again, I mean, you know, it doesn't have to be sort of in the old-fashioned religious sense, but I'm interested you put spirituality as one of those four blocks that you mentioned. What part do you think that plays, and how does that look in modern life with religion on the decline?
Well, we talk about a sense of purpose. So we call it spiritual. You know, we were challenged early days, obviously working with the guys in the States, they got it. Because they said, listen, you could be in a job that pays you really good money, gives you a great lifestyle, but you hate being there every day. You're going, at some point, you're going to be burnt out and hate that job. So it's, you know, we're becoming in this whole capitalist lifestyle where, you know, we need money to have a lifestyle, but if there's no sense of purpose with it, you won't last long in it. You'll be burnt out, and you've seen people have that. We're finding that a lot of people are looking at mid-career changing jobs. They're anxious. They don't know what they're going to do. That sense of purpose, even for myself, you know, I was working in a corporate environment providing behavioral support. I enjoyed it, but I thought, no, I want to go back into the clinical work because that's where I got my greatest sense of purpose, because I was burnt out as well. And I guess that's the biggest challenge, is finding your niche and working it out. But the sense of purpose element is massive. I remember having a colleague. He was a very senior partner at a management consultancy firm. And he said, look, I've had enough of this. I want to quit everything. I just love to make coffees. And I said, why don't you just go downstairs, speak to the local barista where you get your coffee, to teach you how to make coffee? Because I don't think you're going to be a business owner and learn all the trips and traps of business owning. And so he did that. And he said, oh, it's a lot more to it than what he thought. And yeah. I'm sure there is, right? But that's what you're doing. Yeah. You're looking at rose colored glasses on the outside.
Yeah.
At other things, thinking, oh, that's easy. Well, yeah. But it's got its own pitfalls as well. So yeah. It's about understanding your purpose or having hobbies. You might not become the next superstar barista, you know, and have a great coffee shop and a successful business, but you can go and why can't you just have that as a hobby and get yes. a nice coffee machine and do that? So incremental change.
But then it's about time, isn't it? I know so many people are just, you know, back to, they've got brain fog. They're absolutely knackered. They're working these long hours, especially after COVID. I mean, you know, I think work is taking a little bit of the piss basically, because that still people haven't really gone back to work as we're speaking now in, where are we? April 2022. They haven't gone back to work. So people are still actually working from home. And because there's no commuting time, that's two more hours people are putting in. I mean, it's good in many ways because they just step off the computer and straight into dinner. But you know, where are the hobby time? Where have we got the time? Or where is people, you know, people like that sort of almost, they've worked really hard, so they want the treats, you know, rather than they work really hard. Now I have to, in a way, you have to work at a hobby, don't you?
Yeah, you do. I mean, the other thing as well, it's being social, finding a hobby. These are all this is how society started. Having hobbies, that's how you create new friends. I mean, having moved back to London, I was in Manchester for a while. How did I meet people in Manchester? It was when the gyms reopened up, there was, you know, outdoor activities going on. I just joined a couple of the outdoor activities because I was always in the gym, but the gyms were closed, right? So how do you meet people? And then, so it's about being social and doing that and doing your hobbies. If you leave your hobbies, then you sort of say to yourself, well, is it just work? Is that all I've got left in my life? People start to raise a lot of questions.
Yeah, well, a lot of nutritionists and NTs, nutritional therapists, hobby is nutrition, you know. So in fact, we're working in our hobby, which brings its own problems sometimes, you know, in terms of, you know, we can lack that commercial drive. I mean, some people have it, but other people, you know, are doing it because of the, you know, they're doing it for some deeper purpose. You know, it's a huge thing, especially food, which is so visceral. It's the only thing, one of the only things, obviously the other thing you can think of is what happens when you eat the food and then what happens, but basically food is one of the only things we all do, you know, isn't it? It's that we all have to eat, so it's something that's so linked society. So yeah, so I think it's a really useful tool, the resilience factor tool, in order for first of all, if you're using it as a alongside your clinical work, to understand those broader lifestyle factors. And you know what? It's because it's a test. People love it because it's like it's all about them, you know. And I mean, I did it, and I would recommend anybody contact Amit. And you know, it's really good value. So it's really, we're talking, what are we talking here, for just 20 quid? Is
correct.
It per test?
Right, yeah.
So, you know, I'd recommend everybody just get in touch and do it for yourself. From there, you know, absolutely from there, understand what it is, because I did it and I was trying to cheat it, you know, because I was just thinking, I don't need this, you know. Like, do you know what I mean? It's uncheatable, because I was like, oh my God, that's so me. And I was thinking, I was like, yeah, I understand how these questionnaires work. So there's no actual cheating it, funnily enough, because it's asking you in ways that you don't really understand what it's getting at. So it's no point trying to second guess. And anyway, if you do, it still gets you completely right. So don't even try, guys. But yeah, get a hold of, you know, have a look for yourself, and then you can get bought into actually how it can help you. And then, you know, it's such a reasonable thing to offer. You know, another thing I find a reasonable kind of, what do you call it, like a worm on a hook to get people to engage with you, clients to engage with you, is the hair mineral analysis some people use. It's a very, very reasonable test. I mean, I've lost track of how much it is now, but it's a reasonable test to do. But this is reasonable to do to get people kind of interested, excited, and realizing that they might have a little issue that they need to iron out with all of your help. So yeah, fantastic. So Amit, how can people get hold of you? Is there anything else you'd like to say? I mean, do you think we've missed out anything?
Yes, you and I can talk forever, Kate.
We can, guys. So yeah, we can. I think, joking aside, we won't go into some of our more controversial topics, but because we can do that. But I just think, you know, generally accepted position is that, you know, obviously lots of harm has been done during this period, through a lot of mechanisms. And I think this is a way to really pick this up because some of these things aren't talked about, you know, even with your clients, guys, is that, you know, people will say, I'm fine, you know, even if they come to you for a health problem. I used to have that the whole time. I'd, you know, sit down with people. The first thing they'd say is client. The first thing they would say is, I'd say, so let's look at your diet. They say, listen, my diet is really good. You're like, why are you coming to a nutritionist then? It's like, really? And you often miss out these other factors that actually you really need to work on. You know, that and sometimes you get it by instinct to say, do you know what? I think you're in the wrong job. But you can't really say that without any proof. So anyway, so I don't know if you can pick any of that blurb, Amit, but what would you, so first of all, you know, your comments on the harms, you know, I mean, general harms that aren't being picked up. Are you finding that actually?
I think people are overpressured, under time, extremely busy, and a little bit lost to a degree. And then the other things creep in. You know, you're overthinking, you're finding that, you know, is this going to be my new life? What's next? And then it's the whole catastrophizing and all this
sort of stuff. Yeah, but I mean, it's sort of justified because, as I say, who would have thought, you know, 2 years ago, whatever it was, you know, two and a bit years ago now, you know, this came out of a sort of clear blue sky in one way, thwacked us between the eyes. And it's sort of like how much... you know, we've been so out of control, and some people are very good with that, i.e. letting a huge gravitational force control them, but other people are really not good at being controlled to that degree, and it's, you know, caused a lot of harm. I mean, actually, Amit, is it suitable for children, or is this much more an adult's test?
No,
really,
it is for children as well. We're seeing a lot of children with like ADHD or behavioral issues. Parents are coming with their children. So it does work. Children actually are a lot more resilient than what people think. So for them, they can change and make the cognitive changes a lot faster than adults.
Right. So for the neurotherapy work, you mean you use the children, but so that could presumably, what kind of conditions do they turn up with? ADHD
they've either seen a clinical psych, or, you know, they've seen a psychologist or a care worker that said, you know, the child is disruptive, having behavioral issues, and then they've been obviously then later gone to a psychologist or a psychiatrist and been admitted to, you know, taking like the Ritalin and other types of drugs as well, and the parents want them off the drugs, or they don't want to do it anymore, and they're thinking, well, what else can we provide? And then look, there are numerous, I think there's over 8,000 peer-reviewed articles on neurotherapy. It does work. There's a lot of my peers in America that specialize in children. I do that on a case-by-case basis, but it does work. And I feel for parents, I really do. I've got a couple of younger sort of children doing that. I do feel for them because they've tried everything. They want the best outcomes for their children, and unfortunately, you know,
I'm thinking that with the phones as well, you know, we've just gone off on a whole lot of another discussion, but with phones, that must be because in a way that's, you know, you're using a device in effect to train the attention of, you know, the brain. But the brain must be like so scattered all over the shop because of the phone. I mean, can you see that, or is it too difficult because you've the phone has already been, well, the phone's been around for whatever it is now, 15 years.
It's anything that takes your attention and focus away. And I mean, we sort of hate to say it, but we do ask the parents, like social media, like the children, even adults that are more presenting with seeing clinicians like myself, because they are spending a lot of time on social media.
Mm.
You know, it's that's constant being on, the pressure to be on. You know, I've got a couple of athletes as well that we've trained. The more time they spend on social media, they're finding their attention and focus is lacking because it's going elsewhere.
Attention.
Yeah, we're in an attention economy. You look everywhere, someone's trying to get your attention. And where do you focus your attention? Do you focus on the task that you're undertaking right now, you and I having a chat, or is it on the phone that's over there, or is it? And that they're the things that I guess older generations would say, having manners and you know, eye contact and all that. But when your eyes are constantly bombarded by external stimuli, where do you, your poor brain is just a pattern recognizing machine. It just recognizes patterns and habits, and you've got to break those habits and patterns. And that's where neurotherapy, having that training, can help people break a lot of these behaviors through the habits and patterns that are formed. And, you know, unfortunately, us as parents, I'm a parent as well. You have habits and patterns in the house that the children pick up on. They're the cues to inform their behavior. And sometimes you can be the worst person in that environment because you're providing those right cues for the behavior to be set off. So we like to work with everyone to sort of educate. I guess education and awareness is the biggest part. And then the diagnosis and the treatment comes after. But sometimes it's simple as sitting down with a parent saying, look, we can take you from point A to point B over time. Can't tell you how much time right now because we just started. But you need to also agree that you need to look at your own patterns as well and those cues you're giving, because that's how we live.
It's interesting, isn't it, though, that, you know, we talk academically about, you know, like I've got a 16-year-old, and in effect it's quite difficult with 16-year-olds because they're all peer-to-peer, all of their friends are doing that, and actually there comes a point where you're, you know, preventing the phone use is almost, well, you know, they're not sort of children anymore, but they're, you know, they've got to understand how it's affecting them. So you can't really tick them off and take their phone away at 16, 17, because you disrupt the harmony of the household. I'm all for the harmony of the household. But on the same time, you know, it's that sort of, yeah, and so that's the first thing. I tend to sort of try and put parameters, like she's definitely not allowed the phone in the bedroom, you know, but, you know, they just find a different way. They're so cunning. It's like, you know, okay, so, you know, so let's all keep our phones downstairs, you know, whatever. And the next thing you know, she's got the iPad. It's so addictive. So, so then that's the first thing. The second thing is your own self, as you so rightly pointed out, the habits within the family, you know, actually. So, I mean, I don't think I'm a big phone user, but my phone thinks I'm a big phone user. I don't know who's using my phone when I'm not using it. But, you know, it comes up with that little, so you've used the screen, you know, like 17 hours today. I'm like, no, I haven't. You know, you're lying. But, you know, I don't know, because I use it a lot for podcasts and stuff. And I don't use it for social media at all. You know, I did in the pandemic, because I was addicted to Telegram. So I was like, you know, which I've completely weaned myself off, like a drug addict now. But anyway, so.
Hey, look, it's behaviors and patterns. And like these are all tools. And if we use them right, that's no problem. When it becomes, it's impairing your life, it's an issue. And look, I've got a 12-year-old now, got a phone last year, and I've noticed during their school holidays, because they're on school holidays, that its phone is becoming a bit of an issue. But again, I say, look, you know, if you want to be grown up about it, I won't take it away from you, but you're spending a lot of time on your phone and it's starting to impair what you want to do. You know, your friends want to catch up and you're always on your phone. And so I guess it's about teaching sort of levels of control. And it's hard. It's hard for some people, harder than others. But if anything can be good and bad in the same token, but it's about having that balance and really looking at, it's a tool. I need to use it when I need to use it. It's not going to control my life, because you've got the big world out there to live. And these things are just all a distraction, really.
Well, since this whole sort of pandemic has worn off, we've got another threat, you know, obviously, as you alluded to, which is sort of like, oh, never mind, it's just world war. Oh, well, that was just the run up. So no problem. But and I'm not making light of that, by the way. But it's that the other thing I was reminded of, which I put on the really on the back burner, was, of course, the EMFs that come off these flipping phones. And of course, I'm very aware of that. But I mean, I carry the thing around with me the whole time. I do try and put it on airplane mode when I remember. But, you know, of course, that's a whole nother level of stress on the body, isn't it? That we're not even starting to understand. So that must affect the brain. And can you measure that, or can you see that, or is this just like too much of a granular detail for you?
Yeah, look, we're not really addressing that, but there are a lot of early day studies out of Scandinavia that looked at EMF radiation, because obviously Ericsson was based there. So, and then you had later Nokia. So they have a lot of studies to suggest to EMF. But like anything, again, I mean, these are just tools. We don't need them to be, you know, taking over our lives 24/7. And it's just how we use them effectively.
Yeah, absolutely. And be mindful of the, you know, be mindful of all those things, you know, in our resilience bucket, which is, you know, contributing to our health. So, you know, that is obviously good relationships. It is diet and nutrition. Obviously, it is the meditation thing, you know, the mind, control of the mind, or at least focus of the mind, you know, and exercise. And anything else? Don't know. And the leaks in the bucket, which are all of these other things, which are chemicals, stress, and all the rest of it. But the key is measuring where we've got that hole in the bucket and being able to guide people to say, right, that's where you need to plug the hole. And with that, the bucket fills up again with resilient health.
Correct. Well said.
So, Amit, where can people find you? Where can they, you know, have a go? I would really say to everybody, have a go with this resilience factor. It's really reasonable. I think you get a lot of information, and it's this brilliant marketing hook to get people into your clinic and engaged with their health. So where do they find that bit?
Yeah, sure. You can go to the website, theresiliencefactor.com. Or you can drop us email at info@theresiliencefactor.com.
And what about your own work with your neurotherapy?
Yep, you can just shoot me an email. So it's amit@theresiliencefactor.com.
Fine. Yeah. So people can find out that way, because I think that's really intriguing as well. Fantastic, Amit. So it remains for me to say thank you so much. And to everybody listening, thank you. And good afternoon.